Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to a special edition of the Lob podcast with These Football Times. My name is Stuart Horsfield. And before we introduce our very special guest today, I'd just like to introduce my two usual co-conspirators on such an occasion. First of all, Mr. Stephen Scragg. Stephen, welcome.
Oh, how are we doing, Stuart?
Good. Looking forward to this?
Oh, massively. I completely enjoyed this. Totally barking up my tree. And yeah, I'm massively looking forward to the next 40 minutes.
Excellent. And obviously, Gary, I guess memories for you in this particular episode.
Absolutely, Paul. Some great memories. Some great memories and some sort of irritated memories as well. And the documentary is brilliant. I mean, absolutely brilliant. For any football fan of any age, there's so much in there. And looking forward to chatting with our special guest about it. The great work he did on producing the documentary.
Brilliant. So obviously on to the most important person today, obviously not Stephen, Gary or myself, his guest, probably more well known for touchline commentating, hosting ITV's Football League Extra, a familiar face at many of the world's greatest sporting events. But today it's his skill as documentary maker that we want to talk about today, and in particular, the upcoming Finding Jack Charlton documentary, which the three of us have all been incredibly lucky enough to have a preview of. Mr. Gabriel Clark. Gabriel, welcome and thanks for joining us.
I've never had an intro like that before, I tell you.
When you've got spare time, it's amazing what you can do.
Thank you. Yeah, it's good to be with you guys, and I'm glad you were able to watch the film, and thank you very much for your feedback. We've had a good response to it, Finding Jack Charlton. For those who haven't seen it, it's about the legend that is Jack Charlton. Use that word sparingly, but in this case, it's fitting. It interweaves the story of Jack, the player, but essentially the manager during his transformative time in charge of Ireland. What he was able to do as an Englishman in a country that was at the time not having its best relationship with Great Britain, and how he transformed that nation, with also other elements of his story, his relationship with his brother, his relationship with Paul McGrath, his relationship with football, and his life with dementia in the last 18 months or so of his life, which we were able to cover, thanks very much to his wife, Pat, and his son, John.
It's a great overview, and it's funny because I've made a few notes on some of the things, certainly from a personal perspective, to chat about, and Paul McGrath is right up there in that relationship. But before that, I suppose, Stephen, I'll just come to you quickly then. Jack Charlton, for you, your sort of thoughts?
An incredible personality, you know, not old enough to remember any of his playing days, but, you know, as an omnipresent figure in football, both, you know, in the commentary box, I remember him alongside Brian Moore, you know, various cup finals and, you know, other huge games, and his presence as a football manager. My first recollection of Jack Charlton was as Sheffield Wednesday manager. So I remember those days, and a polarising spell at Newcastle United where he seemed to upset Peter Beardsley quite a lot. I remember reading his autobiography. But it was that uncompromising side of him that I just found absolutely fascinating. You know, such a brilliant character, and the best way I think I could describe him is as a maverick. You know, he fits that 1970s kind of identikit maverick, you know, that we associate with the Stan Bowles and the Rodney Marsh, you know, Frank Worthington and all of these attacking players, whereas Jack Charlton was the absolute opposite on the football pitch, yet his personality is as maverick as any of those great attackers.
Gary, I mean, obviously you mentioned sort of in your intro the sort of, I'm not going to say the love-hate relationship they have with him, but certainly as a Chelsea fan, I guess your opinions of Jack Charlton, I'm not saying they're different to everybody else's, but you'll have your own opinions.
Of course, and, you know, one of those sort of honoured rivals. I mean, I, you know, I, most of Chelsea era was the sort of 70s, Peter Osgood, and Jack Charlton, and we just say, had this little black book with two or three names in. I'm damn sure Peter Osgood was one of them, because every time Chelsea played Leeds, my God, Jack Charlton must have been like a nightmare to play against, because such a big guy and uncompromising, shall we say, as a defender. But a massive, massive part of the hugely successful Leeds team of that era. And, you know, it's not, when I say uncompromising, I mean, that's not an insult. That's basically, it's compromising. It's how football was played in those days. And, Jack Charlton, Norman Hunter, Paul Reaney, Terry Cooper, Billy Bremner, Johnny Giles, Eddie Gray, Mick Jones, Alan Clark, Eddie Gray, Peter Lorimer. But the names just trip off the tongue. And Jack Charlton is absolutely 100% star amongst those players.
Everyone's so far, Gabriel has sort of mentioned, you know, Jack Charlton, you know, the personality and that uncompromising nature. But for me watching it, I think the thing that I was fascinated by the most were the notes, the handwritten notes, and that the sort of the bringing to the fore on the screen of sentences and statements. And for me personally, I think I learned more about Jack Charlton from those parts than the footage and the interviews. I guess, where did the idea come from? But was that something that became quite clear quite early?
No, I mean, I think it was probably on about the third or fourth time when we were up in the Northeast filming at the house that, we'd had a chat with Pat, his wife, and son John as well about, you know, photos or archive. And we'd got a tip off about some footage from Italia 90, which I'll tell you about. It's a wonderful story about how we got the footage that you see in the film from Italia 90 behind the scenes at the Irish Team Hotel. But the notes was something that just happened in passing. The producer, Pete Thomas, was up there. I wasn't up there that day. And she said, what about these notes? I've got some of his notes. You know, he did notes before he did after dinner speeches, and we kept them in this box. And she brings out this box and another box and another box. And it's just absolute masses of these notes. And I mean, some of them you see in the installation that we built in the film. And so they're on menus, they're on bits of paper, they're on notepads, they're on tactical pads. And it really is, it was wonderful to see, because it gives you an insight into, I think, this ability that all the great managers have to boil things down to simple points. So it's simple philosophy, simple points, bullet points. I mean, there are a few jokes thrown in there, and there's anecdotes, and there's, you know, reference this gag and tell this story, and don't tell this story for this function because they don't like swearing. But in amongst all that, you had some of these wonderful philosophies, bullet points, which I'm sure today the LMA do these courses where a lot of these, you know, a lot of these are basically on the syllabus, the philosophies that he's talking about. For instance, you're at your strongest when you go into a team, when you're instantly at a team, that's when you're at your strongest, as soon as you move in. Or be a dictator, but be a nice one, which really, in my opinion, summed up the man. And that's why we kept it to the very end of the film, because it was his philosophy. And make sure they have a good time, but within, you know, within a limit. And I think all that to me was, I'm glad it landed with you, because we didn't want to overuse it. But equally, it's very important when it comes to some of the tactical materials that you see. But it's vital, I think, in giving you an insight into the man. And I think how much, as a manager, he was absolutely spot on at his best, ahead of his time in many ways, I think, tactically. But this ability that all the great managers have to simplify it down to key points so that players can understand and that the team can function to its best possible way.
The one about the dictator is actually my favourite quote, like I said, right at the end. Stephen, I suppose, I think for me what the notes did, and this is probably ignorance on my part, the notes seem to demonstrate an incredible, I say, philosophical intelligence, which really isn't easy to say, a philosophical intelligence that I wasn't aware that he possessed.
Yeah, and I think it's great, like Gabriel says, it's that simplicity as well. There's almost like a blunt nature to each bullet point, but it's absolutely him though, and then that's one of the big things that comes across in this centerpiece of the notes and how it focuses on certain certain things that he's put down, and that line at the end about him being, you know, be a dictator but be a nice one is the perfect, like, the cherry on the cake basically at the end. So yeah, I mean, I totally got that. You know, it's something I do, you know, as a writer. I have tons of notes just strewn around. You know, I can use a computer and you know, but I still need the written notes because I'll be anywhere at any point. And I got that completely because you could see the notes and think he'll have been, you know, out walking somewhere, he'd have been fishing, whatever he'd have been doing, something would have sprung to mind and he'd have grabbed a scrap of paper and a pen and some kind of writing implement and he'd have jotted it down, stuffed it in his pocket. And it's exactly the type of thing that I do at times. So yeah, for me, it was one of the, you know, great parts of the documentary to me to constantly come back to this set of notes, and it was a wonderful part of the documentary.
For you, Gary, I suppose what it typifies, and Gabriel sort of talks about it there with the, you know, with the LMA syllabus, but the stuff that's written there is, it's almost contemporary in its meaning and understanding.
Yeah, I mean, when I first saw this and looking through the notes, because obviously with the camera goes this quite a few times, and not only the one that you focus on, but you can see all of the notes around it, and you're thinking, you know, this guy was quite a bit ahead of his time, the way he approached things, and reducing things to, you know, as Gabriel said, to simple points that players can understand and appreciate, to that get the message over in a sort of non-convoluted way. And I think it was one of Jack Charlton's great talents as a manager to make the game as simple to understand for the players as he could. There's a penchant around certain managers to sort of create this mystique of some kind of, you know, I don't know, Zen philosophy about football. And it's, you know, it's not that complicated a game, and Jack Charlton was never falling into that trap. And as I say, you know, I certainly got the impression that given the era when these notes were written, it was very much ahead of its time.
Just coming to that, Gabriel, one thing I wanted to jump to actually, as we've chatted about there, and that's his relationship with the FA. There's a great sort of in the opening part, you know, the FA never got back to him and is still waiting for them to get well, was still waiting to get back to him at the time of recording. Do you think the FA didn't truly understand the potential within Jack Charlton as a manager as well?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I think what I would say maybe in fairness to the FA, as time moved on, would be that, you know, Jack's CV wasn't that strong in club management after Middlesbrough. But it was at that time at Middlesbrough when he was told to apply. So I think it would have been 77. When post-Revy. So that was when he was told to apply and they didn't get back to him. And obviously, I'm not going to, that's it then, I'm done. You know, I'm not going to go near you. Thank you very much. And whether they really understood it, they certainly understood how good he was in Stuttgart in 88. You know, and, you know, Des Casey tells us, secretary of the FAI really tells it wonderfully in the film where, you know, he's there with Milicic, who slagged off Jack, Bert Milicic, who slagged off Jack to Des Casey several times in the past and saying, what have you got this fella in charge for? You know, he's not the man for you. And there are England losing to Jack's team in Stuttgart, the day that really transformed Irish football. That's what triggered it all from that point. And Jack's Ireland never lost to England. At that,
it's pretty.
Can you just say something? I mean, you gave a most good point about Jack Charlton's CV, but for the FA not even to reply to an application from a guy who won the World Cup as a player is disgrace. It's an embarrassment. Absolute embarrassment.
Yeah, and I think that without a shadow of a doubt, that certainly resonates still with the family, and obviously did with Jack. I think when you make a good point in relation to the boys of 66, and obviously as a collective, we know how the FA only now maybe are realising that they've not been recognised in a way they should have been.
Yeah, how dare they? How dare they?
Like I said, I was just going to come to you then, Stephen, and I guess, you know, like we said, that result in Stuttgart, you know, we often chat about the major championships in the 80s, but that European Championship was such a pivotal moment, as Gabriel just said there, for Irish football. And especially when there were so many English accented people, shall we say, playing for the Ireland squad. But as a collective, the fuel that it must have given Jack Charlton that must have then been passed on to that group of players.
Yeah, and I think there's a great part in the documentary where he's interviewed and he's asked about this, and the general gist of the answer is that they're here because they want to be, and and that was what set it up for me, was that it said everything about that Ireland side, and I think everything comes down to the organisation for him as well, and just how organised that side was going into that tournament and going up against England. And we will go back to the notes again, and that meticulous nature of observation is what it comes down to. But it's that marrying that observation with the simplicity that Gabriel spoke of before, and always a great believer in the best football being the simplest football. Whatever aesthetic version that is, whether that's total football or whether that's Graham Taylor's percentage playing version of football at Watford that would ally a little bit of skill on the wings as well, it's still organised, and it was still a simple style of football for his players to play and to be sent out onto the pitch to do. And it was just the perfect storm. It was the perfect time. It was the perfect place to do it. Didn't seem like that at the time. The great part where Paul McGrath was talking about how incredulous he was that, the Irish FA would employ an Englishman in, 85, 86. It seems incredulous now to think that you could airdrop a former England international into that job there and then at that point in time in the culture and the environment that, the political storm that was around at that period of time. Yet, it all made sense in some manner.
I was just going to ask you about that, Gabriel, actually. The political situation between England and Ireland, and like, as Stephen said there, the appointment of an Englishman. But do you think, or did you get the feeling that actually the appointment of such an incredibly blunt, straight-talking, no-nonsense personality was actually exactly what was needed to almost bridge that gap and bring those English accented players across to sort of play?
Yeah, I think it obviously Jack had in mind that there was some English accented second and third generation players out there that he could draw upon, and he obviously did that. I think what was also required from a management point of view was a shake-up, because Ireland had some talented players. And, David O'Leary among them. And obviously the film documents David's roller coaster ride with Jack. They had Liam Brady. They had several other talented players. Ronnie Whelan didn't always get on with Jack and didn't make his team in 1990. I think Jack felt that there was some maybe of the talented Irish team who'd underperformed, not done it for their national team, and they hadn't. Despite having, these are players who play for top clubs in England, and Jack saw, he was shrewd enough to look at the squad that he had, and a lot of them from Liverpool, Arsenal, Man United, big clubs they were playing for at the time, as well as those sort of Andy Townsends and others who would come through thanks to his research, and Mick McCarthy's. So he saw the base was there. He also saw there are some of these guys who aren't going to do it my way, and I'll have to ease them out, or I'll just get, I'll tell them they're out to begin with, as he did with O'Leary, and I'll pick them when I want to pick them. And then in terms of the Englishness, I think what enabled Jack to connect with Ireland was that he was not your typical Irish view of an Englishman. He wasn't the plummy-voiced politician that they were used to hearing. He wasn't this posh bloke who'd come over them and there and patronise them. That he wasn't, this sort of figure from Thatcher's cabinet, which is what the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland were used to seeing. He was like them. He was one of them. Only he had a Geordie accent and not an Irish one. But essentially, they were one and the same. And so there was that natural sort of cultural fit, which nobody really could have predicted, not the FAI. They didn't know that was going to happen. They just were happy to have a big name who, as you say, knew what he wanted. Someone who could shake it up a bit. But they got more than that. They got this incredible cultural personality who matched exactly their own values.
Gary, do you think in terms of, you know, as we just said there, you know, how, as Gabriel's just mentioned, in terms of that personality, but do you think there was also an element of bravery going into that role, bearing in mind the political sort of backdrop that he was going into?
I guess there must be an element of it, but just sort of picking on what Gabriel said there, you know, the northeast of England has a less than harmonious relationship with London, and so does Northern Ireland. So there is a sort of, you know, I think Gabriel's hit the nail on the head there. There is that sort of similarity that he was perceived as less of being, he wasn't a London guy. He came from a deprived area as much as Northern Ireland was. But go back to your question. I mean, yes, there must be. There must be, given the troubles at the time. But I think Jack Charlton was the sort of guy who would have a fairly sanguine view of that sort of thing. And, you know, if going to Republic of Ireland and bringing success helped to heal, you know, some society's wounds, fantastic, fantastic. And, you know, that's certainly what he did. And I think he had that sort of down-to-earth mentality, personality, that, you know, he knew what his job was going to be, and he hadn't got that highfalutin, know-it-all attitude of politics that a lot of people cause problems with.
You know, we've discussed his sort of personality quite a bit here, Gabriel, but, you know, as we mentioned right at the beginning, one of the key, for me, almost the key narrative or the key relationship that comes out is his relationship with Paul McGrath, whose backstory himself, you know, as it's told in the documentary, you know, the setting the scene of Paul McGrath's backstory, is a story in itself. But then when you have these sort of two almost contrasting figures meet, and, you know, we talk about Jack Charlton's uncompromising nature, and yet he almost proves to be the perfect ally for this incredibly complicated personality that is Paul McGrath.
Mm. Yeah, that's man management, you know, and... you know, I think pretty much everybody we spoke to, I mean, you know, there's a lovely little cameo from Charlie O'Leary, the kit man in the film. We did a lovely interview with Charlie, but, you know, the two bits that got in were really the anecdotal bits, one around the Pope and then the one around just Jack, the man manager, and how he treated, whether you were the superstar on the team. Well, there was never really a superstar on that team. Jack was the superstar. And, you know, I think his ego quite like that too, let's be honest. But equally, he was able to manage superbly, whether it was the kit man or whether it was somebody as complex as Paul. And I think probably that relationship was based on, A, the fact that Paul was almost an undiscovered... I think Jack was the first to really recognise how good Paul was, because at that time when he became manager... Paul was having a very difficult time at Manchester United with Sir Alex Ferguson. And, you know, Ferguson essentially got rid of Paul. And in Paul's book, Paul says that Sir Alex encouraged him to retire because his knees were so bad, but also there was this issue with alcohol. Whereas, so I think on a day-to-day basis, Paul might have been very difficult for anyone to manage, even Jack. But coming to Ireland, seeing the potential in Paul, the player, as a midfielder and then as a centre-back, was something that nobody had seen before. And also they were able, obviously they needed him. First of all, they needed him as a player. That was essential to Jack's tactical plan to begin with, was this pivot player in the midfield who could basically be a third centre-half, which Paul was in the 88 tournament. And then from there, it was, right, how do we manage this guy to ensure that he's able to come to Ireland each time and play with us? We lock him in his hotel room, we put someone on the door, we try and help him with his travel, and we deal with him when he's at his worst. We don't get rid of him, we don't kick him off the team, because that would possibly kill him. We deal with him and we keep him, we love him, and from that grew this relationship, which got its wonderful conclusion in the 94 World Cup, when Paul had the greatest display by any Irish player. And that's why Paul McGrath is really regarded today as the greatest of all Irish players.
I guess, you know, Stephen, you'll have an appreciation of Paul McGrath, the player. You know, I'm sure you've seen him at Anfield. But I guess, you know, in the document, and this is what really good documentaries do, they sort of offer alternative strands, alternative threads of interest to go and look at, to go and investigate. Obviously, people who don't know or are too young to remember Paul McGrath the player, once they've watched this, should really go and have a look at Paul McGrath the player as well.
Oh, without doubt. You know, he was massively, massively talented. One point when Manchester United were trying to sell Brian Robson to Juventus around about 84-ish, and all the talk at the time was that Paul McGrath was good enough to fill the void. And he would do when he was in, when Robson was injured. So the talent was never really in doubt. The temperament was the big thing with Paul McGrath, and this is kind of like the most electric part of the documentary is Paul McGrath's journey with Jack. And I saw a lot of parallels with Jack's relationship with Ireland, the national team. The country, Paul McGrath was certain parallels with kind of like Sepp Piontek and with Denmark and Preben Elkjær. Elkjær was a troubled soul to some description, you know, not to the depths of the alcoholism that Paul McGrath hit, but you know, there were certain parallels, not in the style of the play of the teams, but within that makeup that Jack came in, and he jettisoned certain players because no matter how talented they were, he didn't think they were gonna either give the all or fit the demographic of the team that he wanted. And Piontek did the same thing with Denmark. Birger Jensen, very talented goalkeeper, you know, would tip up for international games, not really with his heart in it. He just came back for the booze up after the match, basically. So he was jettisoned, and inferior goalkeepers were played because they were completely sold into the concept of what Piontek was trying to do. But he had this one exception, and that was Elkjær, and he gave him chance after chance after chance to redeem himself, to play the central pivotal part of this Denmark side. And this is what Jack Charlton did with Paul McGrath with Ireland. And you know, there's that bit in the documentary where you know, that threat was made: if you don't get off the bus, you'll never play for Ireland again. And you know, this was something that for anyone else, you know, that would have meant the end. But this is the one concession, the one, you know, soul to save. And Jack stepped up and he did it. You know, when he probably wouldn't have done that for a Ronnie Whelan or anyone else. And we say that relationship with David O'Leary, and feeling like that David O'Leary perhaps didn't give his all, you know, for his nation. And that's probably, David O'Leary will argue that point down. But this is how Jack Charlton saw it. But he was fully invested in the talent and the person in Paul McGrath. And he seemed to alter Jack's point of view as much as he helped McGrath, I think.
I mean, it's strange, Gary, isn't it? Two, you know, incredibly uncompromising characters in Alex Ferguson and Jack Charlton. One manages to see and find the very best in the player, and one, you know, as we said there, wants to get rid. It's strange, isn't it, how do two different managers can see the same player?
It is, and it's how different managers see different players as well. I mean, Paul McGrath was far from being the only person with the alcohol problem at Manchester United. Far, far away from being the only person in the squad. But the Paul McGrath thing in the documentary, the Paul McGrath elements. When I watched the documentary, I was ill. I had a streaming cold, so I actually watched it lying in bed. And I'm still not sure whether it was the cold or whether it was the part where Paul McGrath standing on the beach reflecting on Jack Charlton, how he was treated. That made the tears roll a little bit, but they did. And, you know, Gary just used the phrase earlier that, you know, Jack Charlton loved him. And, you know, that comes through, that absolutely beams through. And, you know, Paul McGrath never hit the heights as a club player, but you know, as Gabriel mentioned in USA 94, this guy was tight, absolute tight. What a player he could have been if his knees hadn't been so dodgy. You know, I mean, people listen to the These Football Times podcast regularly, and me bang on about Barry Holshoff of Ajax fame. He was probably the best centre back I've ever seen play, and libero. Paul McGrath was on that sort of standard. He was of that sort of standard. The height he could have got to if his knees hadn't been so bad. But the heights he got to, actually did get to, were largely due to the love, affection, care and empathy of Jack Charlton.
I've got two points left to cover with you, Gary. That's right. One of them's legacy, but I'll leave that to the end. But one other thing I wanted to touch on, and it's not really answered in the documentary, but it can, again, is another strand that runs through it, and that's the relationship with his brother. Obviously, his brother doesn't appear on screen as such in terms of a talking head contribution. And I just wondered, what you picked up on while you were making it in terms of relationship with Bobby.
Yeah, it's interesting you say it's not really concluded in the documentary, because I sort of hope to a degree that it is because of what John Charlton says in the film. Because, I went in with a very open mind. I mean, I knew that obviously there was a background history in relation to difficulties in the family and the relationship between Sir Bobby's wife and the mother of Jack and Bobby, which, one's led to believe wasn't necessarily the best. But there was a sense, I think, of resolution when Sir Bobby was honoured with the Lifetime Achievement Award at the Sports Personality of the Year, some sort of 8-9 years ago, when Jack actually presented the trophy. But then when we started talking to the family about it, and John was saying, I haven't seen my Uncle Bobby for years. And he says, these are two men who've both said the wrong thing and both done the wrong thing, and we'd all like a happy ending. That makes it clear, I think, that their relationship wasn't resolved, sadly. So I think that essentially was how we hoped to answer that question. And fundamentally, what I took from the filming and the research and the stories and looking at material is that, these were two guys who were united by blood, but certainly not by character, and that there was a rivalry there or a difficulty in their relationship from the very start. As we say, when, Jack had to look after Bobby, he resented that. And then Bobby was asked after the World Cup final, you've played with your brother. What was it like to play with your brother in a World Cup final? He says, just like any centre half, which is, it's the very minimum, not willing to give his brother special treatment. And that's just the way I think they were. They were different as people, massively different as people, and lived separate lives, very much so when Jack became a manager and Bobby wasn't able to succeed in management. So I think... And we made the point, obviously, of contacting Lady Norma and Sir Bobby for comment. And Sir Bobby, we discovered, very sadly, had been diagnosed with dementia. That was our line. We initiated that line that you'll have seen this weekend, which the Daily Telegraph followed up on. So she told that line to us first. And it was sad that Sir Bobby wasn't able to contribute in the film. And Lady Norma preferred not to comment on his behalf because that's not the way they want to do things now. So I think what I took away from that is a sense of sadness, but also a lot of families are like that. That's just the way it is in an awful lot of families. And why should a superstar brothers necessarily be any different?
Yeah, I think you're right in terms of the unresolvedness comes from almost not making up before it became too late, I think is probably where I was, with regards to the unresolvedness.
Yeah, I think they would have had opportunity. Mm. They would have had opportunity to do that, I think, but I just don't think that that was possible.
Gary, I'll come to you first on this one. Obviously probably the most iconic brothers in English football. And yet, as the documentary does demonstrate and allude to, they were probably teammates first and foremost, then brothers.
And perhaps the brother thing was quite a wide distance beyond teammates. Gabriel's quite right. This isn't unusual. Why should it be different for players because they were superstar footballers who shared a World Cup winning stage? Why should they be different? A lot of families don't have. And I think it's, I don't know, but reading, sort of watching the film and sort of reading what you read about the relationship between the two, it wasn't a particular hateful, malignant relationship. It was more like a distant one, I guess, that they were entirely two, just different people. They had different views about things. And the relationship between Jack and Bobby's mother and Lady Norma obviously didn't help, and it's understandable that Bobby Charlton supported his wife. Entirely understandable. And these things happen. It's a little bit sad, and it would have been nice if before the end there would have been a reconciliation. But, you know, that's the way these things go. It's a bit sad, but there it is, you know, and there's no particular reason why it should be different for footballers.
Just before we finish, Gabriel, I suppose your opinion, your perspective on this. And I mean, Jack Charlton will always be a World Cup winner, and there are so few English World Cup winners as we know. But in terms of what he achieved with Ireland as a manager, is his legacy as a successful manager? I know you can't get any more successful than World Cup winner, but has it almost superseded his legacy as to what he did as a player with what he did achieved in Ireland?
I mean, that was certainly the appeal of the story to me to begin with. I mean, that was something I felt that he hadn't necessarily been given due credit for. And that was one of the appeals of the story, was to the more than football aspect of what he achieved with the team, and how much it resonated into parts of Irish society. This sense that if we can reach a World Cup quarterfinal, we can think about taking on the world at football. Well, we can do anything as a nation. That sense of self-confidence and the transformation of national identity that happened at the end of the 80s and the start of the 90s, which everyone we spoke to who was Irish and plenty who weren't, were, you know, completely and utterly behind as an idea and as something that definitely happened. I mean, how much Jack actually was aware of doing that beyond football, I'm not sure, but it's what happened because of his natural leadership and the way in which he was able to galvanize the team to almost play in the nation's image. So I think that bigger legacy, I mean, to be, as we say at the end of the film, to be awarded the citizenship of Ireland alongside Mandela and Kennedy is pretty amazing, or Mother Teresa isn't bad, is it? And I think that sort of puts it in perspective really and frames that achievement. I mean, and the other thing I think as well, you know, which I've touched on in other interviews, is obviously the dementia aspect. And I think being able to put that across in the film, and the family enabling us to document that, and I'm not saying that has anything whatsoever to do with his legacy, but it also, I think, just hopefully demonstrated as well that even towards the end of his life, he was a man who was just trying to get the maximum still out of himself and his life. That's what he wanted to do. He just wanted to be as inspirational in everything that he did as possible. And that's certainly one of the things that I hope people take from the film.
It is. I mean, just finally with you, you know, Stephen and Gary, I guess, you know, Stephen, you know, we started off this conversation sort of 40 minutes ago about this uncompromising footballer, incredibly blunt. And yet, you know, 40 minutes down the line, you know, we're now talking about, you know, someone who's very brave, a lot of dignity, you know, tried to get the most out of life, brought the best out of others. And I guess our conversation has almost mirrored the documentary that starts with those Leeds United clips, you know, and ends up with those sort of poignant pictures right at the end.
Yeah, I think the great thing about it is it just, as the documentary progresses and it goes along, you can just see exactly how much Jack gives to Ireland, but how much he gets back, and you know, and whether that was, you know, subconscious to him or whether he knew that or acknowledged that, you know, who knows? But you know, he clearly got a lot out of the job, as much as out of the job, I think, as he gave, and it was the dementia theme was the most touching part of it. You know, I've described the parts with McGrath as being the most electric side of it, but you know, the most human side of it was the way that this strong man became gradually more frail. But it was the way that he came back to the surface again, time and again. No more so, and I don't want to give it away, but that final scene at the end, if that doesn't kill you, you know, if that doesn't kind of like reduce you to a bit of a quivering wreck, nothing will. You know, I'm not going to give it away, but you know, that was as a scene stealing moment. That one at the end is just breathtaking.
Gary, for you finally then, post-documentary opinion of Jack Charlton?
I think one of the most poignant parts of the documentary, a shot full of pathos towards the end when the dementia issue, and Pat says to, is this Pat and his wife, am I right, Gabriel, Pat? Yeah, says to him, they love you in Ireland, don't they? And he's, do they? And it's a little bit sad, and he's watching on a laptop about, I think it's this thing you mentioned earlier about around the swimming pool, Italian 90, and I can't remember this. And in our old age, it's memories that keep you warm and the cold nights, and it's almost sad. It's very, very sad that perhaps that was taken away from Jack Charlton, and he was denied being able to recall the pleasure that had given so many years. But sort of, you know, it's the post documentary feelings of Jack Charlton. The documentary is called Finding Jack Charlton, and I think throughout the documentary, Gabriel succeeds in finding Jack Charlton.
Brilliant. Obviously we're living in tricky times. This wonderful documentary, this wonderful film, you know, is due for release. You know, unfortunately, due to COVID, things have changed, but it is due for release on DVD and digital release on the 23rd of November. And like I say, I'm sure the three, well, Stephen and Gabriel especially, is his piece of work, you know, would join me in, you know, it is an absolute must, not only for fans of football, but I think people looking for a human story and a story that is ultimately a story about humanity that just really has football as its backdrop and its narrative that runs right through it. Gabriel, thank you so much for joining us and spending time with us. It's, like I say, it's been wonderful.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much, guys.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.